This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four.
Episode 20, 1972, Part 3.
Hi, my name is Gene Colan, and welcome to my studio.
I was on Daredevil for approximately 6 years. I enjoyed it, every bit of it. It's getting to the point, though, where it's getting very difficult to keep choreographing the same fight scenes and have them look different. And sometimes I would bring it up to Stan, why are there so many fights in all these stories? Why can't we get away from it? He says, because it's what the fans really want to see. I kept it fresh and original by approaching it each time as if it were the first time. Each time I got a story, and each time I handed the story in, I got another one, it was always uppermost in my mind as to how different can I make this one, and this one, and so on. And as they came in, it was almost like an assembly line, but I just threw myself into it, lived another life in a sense. I tried to get into that story myself. I tried to jump into the page and try to imagine what it would be like to see it visually as an outsider. What am I looking for? What am I trying to capture? If there was a fight scene, I would try to do it in a way that would confuse the reader. Because in real life, very often you don't see the details. You just see action, and you don't see things flying much else, but arms and legs and people sailing over tables, but you don't see the details. And very often it's done in a dark room where you can even see less.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome once again to the Marvel Age podcast. I, of course, am one member of the Sarcastic Four. I suppose I'm technically a co-host. My name is Nick Duke. Joining me, as always, are the rest, the other members, beginning with the manager, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
Welcome, scum. Welcome back to awareness. Now that I have you all together, it's time to tell you the reason for all this. I want you to know who I am, how I became this way before I kill you, since that, after all, is what I must do. For you see, I am the Todd Weber of the 1970s. I am the other Todd Weber.
And what are your feelings on the coloreds?
God.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
They never bothered anybody, Nick.
They never did. Oh, God. Nope. The show's off the rails already. Tim Capel. He's also on this show. How are you?
Thank you, Nick, for granting me boons, for one such as I, who would willingly perform any obscene rite to rid myself of this deformed shell you might call a body, including reading these early 1970s Marvel comics.
Speaking of men who will perform any obscene rite, Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
My grotto is hazy with incense and sin. And there is no friend in sight, so I have to do the only logical thing there is to do, and hail Satan.
Hail Satan, indeed. Yeah. Between discussions of racist-ass Captain America and the hailing of Satan, we have quite the show in store for you tonight. This is, of course, the third part of our discussion on 1972 in Marvel. If you've joined us before, you know this is our year-by-year journey through the most important stories in the publishing history of the Marvel Universe, beginning all the way back in 1961, and we've made it 11 years. And here we are going to close out 1972 tonight with some discussion of some books. So let's just jump right into it, guys, and let's start our discussion with a little anniversary issue for The God of Thunder, as Thor 200 was on our list this time out. And it's interesting because Stan Lee had departed the book sometime before, but he actually pops back on now for this, the anniversary issue, to write the tale of Ragnarok, which is interesting, or at least the future vision of Ragnarok. In this one, we get to see the Norns laying down this prophecy of Loki and his ultimate betrayal and how it's going to lead to the destruction of everything. But importantly, it also establishes that as it relates to the Asgardians, the destruction of everything is just one part of this endless cycle of rebirth, because the gods will always be reborn anew upon a new Asgard. And in one of the most predictable statements that's going to be said this entire episode, God, I fucking love this. And that, with that, I will turn it over to the rest of you. Tim, take it away.
I predictably love this as well. And you might be wondering, why is this kind of random one-off issue of Thor on the list? Well, it's an anniversary issue. It's number 200. Didn't really come by that number, honestly, necessarily, you could say. Given
yeah,
that
picked
this
up
is
Journey
a,
into Mysteries numbering.
Right, which was pretty deep in its own numbering, yeah. Was Journey into Mystery. But this is an early 60s. Yeah, it's still an early 60s Marvel title. And it's the first Marvel series now to hit issue 200. So good on Thor there. I believe this is actually what we would now consider, and probably at the time would also be considered, an inventory story. Because it's actually sort of interrupting this ongoing, very serialized drama that Jerry Conway, the book's regular writer, was kind of immersed in. And that's kind of the reason we haven't looked at a lot of Thor in a while. It's just hard to check in on those titles that get, I don't want to say bogged down into the heavy serialization, but if it's long running and it's not anything that important, it just makes it hard to get onto our list, I think. So no disrespect to Jerry Conway there, but we do get Stan Lee and John Buscema returning here, although I believe John Buscema is still the book's regular artist. Mm-hmm. And that makes it a little bit more important than a regular inventory tale. It's not too often you've got an old Stan Lee script lying around in a drawer, but I suspect that was the case here. Kind of similar to that weird last Jack Kirby FF story that kind of got slotted in, I believe last year or the year before that we looked at. So yeah, we get this story of Ragnarok, and it's suitably epic, as you would expect. It's also self-contained, which I like. And yeah, that'll take us back into kind of business as usual on Thor. I don't know when exactly we'll see it again. Although, having said that, I think he's going to make an appearance. And one of your favorite tropes, Nick, but more on that later in the show. But yeah, not much else to add to what you said here other than some of that context. Good stuff. I like this cycle of death and rebirth. It's kind of relatable, especially in the dregs of December here.
Absolutely. Hey, Todd, tell me this. Your favorite part of this Ragnarok story, was it where we saw Odin die and then Thor was cracking jokes 3 minutes later?
Thank you. Thank you for trying to hold me accountable to my opinions. But no, my favorite part of this book was where Ric Flair made a cameo appearance. And let me tell you, this book has everything. It has collapsing bridges. It has Loki. It has Odin. It has Adam and Eve, basically. It has Heimdall and the Rainbow Bridge. It has the Norn Fates, as they are also known. It has the Warriors Three, and it has Baldur. Yes, this is a kind of everything. This is a book tailored. Oh, Surtur. Forgot about Surtur, too.
And the Midgard
Surtur.
Yeah, well, I already mentioned Ric Flair, so... Yes, nice little framing sequence at the beginning and the end, where it places it into this story, Thor versus Pluto, not the dog, but the Roman god. So, yeah, this was great stuff, and classic. Everybody should read it. It's just kind of, well, what does it mean? It means what could happen in the future. So you have to keep your eye out from reading Thor at this point, for events to occur to lead towards this. So interesting stuff, and Stanley is done.
Absolutely. Yes. Russell, your thoughts here on this this Ragnarok, a preview of a sort.
Well, the rest of the panel has said it pretty well. This certainly excited my Midgard Serpent. So, yeah, really, really good stuff beginning to end. John Buscema art is top-notch. He's doing it feels like he's really starting to find his own identity now. It doesn't really feel too much like a Jack Kirby impression so much anymore. It feels like something is starting to stand out. I really appreciated the deep mythology that Stan is creating here. I think that that's really the biggest and most important part of this particular story, is that it's going to become so important to Thor's mythology going forward. A lot of things are going to kind of hinge on this. Ragnarok is going to come up time and time and time again. This really deepens the characters of Thor and Loki to a new degree. Puts a lot of new puzzle pieces on the table for future artists and writers to play with. So really excellent work here from Stan Lee. A nice welcome return, as some of his returns have been hit and miss, but this one is very much a hit.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. Glad to hear that everyone else enjoyed it as much as I did. Moving on, unless anybody has anything further to say on Thor 200, let's hop over to another title that has been routinely praised throughout the history of this show. And that would, of course, be The Amazing Spider-Man. This time out, we're covering Amazing Spider-Man 113 to 115 that kind of picks up pretty much right where we left off the last time we covered some Amazing Spider-Man. So we've read a lot of Spider-Man in 1972, and I got to say, continues to hold up. We've got that Doc Ock cliffhanger that's paying off here as Spider-Man is doing battle with Doc Ock once again. Eventually, we get the introduction of Hammerhead. He's come into play now, and he and Doc Ock are kind of pitted against each other with, of course, Spider-Man caught in the middle, as per usual. And all along, you've got this mystery of where is Aunt May gone? What has happened to her? And as it turns out, she's shacking up with Doc Ock. She's getting a little bit of that tentacle action every night. And good for her is all I can say. But by story's end, she has taken some actions that, let's be honest, she's not been the most sympathetic character throughout this series. And after this last issue, 114 and 115 in particular, very hard to find yourself empathizing very much with Aunt May. But along the way, I think one of my favorite bits is we continue to see, you know, them leaning into the fact that, you know, deep down, Peter Parker is just a normal guy. And his physical ailment this time that is causing him an issue turns out to be an ulcer, which I laughed out loud when I read that, and not in like a, oh my God, that's dumb way. I was like, that's kind of brilliant, because it fits into that whole idea of just Peter Parker as the everyman. And we've seen him for over 100 issues now, just walking around constantly worrying himself silly. And it only stands to reason he would give himself a damn ulcer at some point. So again, predictably, I loved this. Russell, I know you're also a major Spider-Man fan. What'd you make of these three issues?
We are introduced to Spider-Man's greatest foe in this series up to this point, IBS. That is far and away his greatest weakness. But no. Jerry Conway really is starting to kill it on this title. And what I really appreciate about this, though, is that this is pretty low-key. Like some of the mm-hmm. a lot of the other stuff that we read for 72, especially for this part, we deal with a lot of like big world-ending, maybe even universe-shattering stakes throughout. And this is one of the few series that we're reading that really is just focused in on a singular character. This is the Peter Parker story. This is him dealing with everyday life. So I very much appreciate Jerry Conway keeping it low-key and not trying to tell this big, massive epic right away. And he introduces us to some more 1940s gangsters who are, you know, still left over from 30 years prior to this. And that's basically what Hammerhead is and has always been in my mind. So it kind of is what it is. But Doc Ock, as I think we called out in his very first appearance, came out basically fully formed. He's the same character now that he was then, and it's being done incredibly well. Jerry Conway just slipped right in there, and I don't think you could tell the difference between Conway and Stan's writing on Ock. The artwork, again, this continues to be another strong part of the book, but I have forgotten who actually drew this one. So if anybody wants to...
It was Romita.
It was John Romita, yes. John Romita putting his stamp on the book following, of course, the exit of Gil Kane, who has moved on to other, well, unfortunate territory, if you ask me. But
we'll get there.
Yeah. But John Romita really is putting his own stamp on this. His art style is very clean. The characters look like what we would think of as that classic comic book look. This is, I think, the first hints of, you know, the Silver Age is going to come to an end not too long from now. And John Romita is going to be one of those guys who kind of helps to usher in a that new look, that new art style that's going to come along. So you're starting to see it budding here. And that's something I very much appreciate about this whole story. The handling of all the stuff with Gwen was excellent. And like I said before, Jerry Conway has got a really great and unique voice for every character. All these characters don't all talk the same. They don't all act the same. So in that, he's showing some like real brilliance here as a writer. And he's still pretty young whenever he wrote this. And I think that that's one of the keys to success in superhero writing is you got to have that younger voice who thinks in modern terms. And Jerry Conway is really showing off some real chops here. So another excellent series of Spider-Man issues. Can't recommend them enough, especially if you're just looking for something that's very character-driven and focused. This is a good story to get into.
Underrated moment is when, after diagnosing him with an ulcer, he prescribes him a bland diet and tells him to avoid all spicy foods and tomatoes and things of that sort, essentially putting him on what I call the Greg Phillips diet. So that's good. Todd, your thoughts here. I know Russell talked a lot about the art, and you're usually our resident art expert. What are your thoughts on these three Spider-Man issues?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys noticed, but a new name entered as an art assistant here, and his name is Jim Starlin. And
yeah, which is interesting because he's actually listed first on – if you're looking at Marvel Unlimited and the little synopsis before you actually enter into each issue, I believe, yeah, his name is listed first before Jerry Conway's on issues 112 and I believe 113 as well. Well, 113 – and then 114 as well. He's got top billing for whatever reason.
Yeah, I don't know why they do that with Marvel Unlimited, the credit order. Sometimes they'll give the cover artist top billing.
Right.
But here, yeah, the Romita art is solid. Maybe a little sketchy, and I don't mean that it's under under the law or anything like that. I mean, there's a lot of dirty brush strokes, but I like it. It gives it a gritty characteristic. Speaking of Greg Phillips, though, these Doc Ock-centric issues are probably not recommended for our friend Greg, but I enjoyed him because I like the Elton John Doc Ock just fine, gosh darn it. Yep. Boy, Aunt May is a trifling bitch here, though.
She really is.
She's this is some of the worst Aunt May.
I know it will get there later in the book's history with the whole marriage and everything, or the courtship or whatever. Are we supposed to believe that these two are fucking at this point? Because I am going into this with the 100% belief that Aunt May has embraced a love in her older age.
There are some things that people just shouldn't spend the time thinking about because it'll lead them to very dark and unhappy places. But let's talk about Hammerhead. Speaking of dark and unhappy, I can't look at Hammerhead. He makes me uncomfortable. The body horror, body deformity, microcephaly kind of thing. That, yes, this has happened to him. We get his origin story here. But I just don't like looking at the character because it's just not right. You know, something is asymmetrical, and that's because he's missing the top quadrant of his head. Let's also talk about the unique Spider-Man hijinks where he loses his mask and he has to find a costume shop mask. So there are three issues. He's got no eye holes or he doesn't have his polarized lenses, but still really good. And I like that this arc finally kind of came to a close and we have something of a new status quo. You know, Peter's not going to be checking in on Aunt May, we would think, for a while. She's going to be here, but he is going to be worrying about her, and maybe he'll have some more time There is the closure aspect with Gwen where she gets to get the guilt off her chest of sending May away. Or does she? We'll find out in 1973. Overall, come on, you're getting so much value in these issues. These are the most densely scripted and art-packed issues that we read each year. And tremendous value for, you know, your 70s era, what, 20 cents? Yeah, you got a lot of comic and great covers every time, great stories. The Amazing Spider-Man is the place to be in 1972.
There you are. Tim, your thoughts here on these three Spider-Man issues?
Don't you guys hate it when you are brain damaged and, frankly, your skull has been caved in and you're passed out in a gutter?
And they put a steel plate in your head, and then you wake up.
A deranged neurosurgeon comes along, yeah,
and you wake up, and you're having to fight Hulk Hogan, who is taking care of two kids, and Sherman Helmsley is running around, and you're getting, you know, head splitting headaches. Yes, I always hate that.
What movie is that a reference to?
Oh my God, Todd! It's the early 90s classic, Mr. Nancy.
Hammerhead is Thanatos.
It's Thanatos.
Thanatos is Hammerhead.
And then Todd Weber is in the movie, and he can't look at him.
Because he gets ooped out.
He's got a headache.
What an outstanding film.
That was a very bizarre, quick origin. I don't know. I guess Conway is leaving the door open to maybe explore that a little bit further. I would say
who
that I
work with a walking case of CTE.
True.
He's a living embodiment of it. He keeps
it would account quite a lot. Yeah. I like these issues also. I agree with the value statement of Todd as well. I'm a little bit lower on them than you guys. I think I'm kind of just honestly looking for things to, I don't want to say nitpick, but criticize in ASM just because it always is so consistent. And for the sake of not having four people just say the same thing about a story because we all really enjoy it. I did think the art by Romita, yeah, was not as tight as what we're usually accustomed to seeing from him. I wonder if he was maybe just on breakdowns here and Jim Starlin was finishing. I don't know. But it's not bad art. It's just, it didn't say, oh, John Romita, when you look at it. But that's okay. I can't really hold that against the book. I think it fits for this type of story. And yeah, I would definitely agree that this idea of Peter working him up through such nervous exhaustion, I believe is how the doctor puts it, that he has given himself a stomach ulcer. It's made even greater by the fact that he's even thinking the whole time, just, oh, what could it be? He's worrying, which is just exacerbating this problem. He's like, am I going to grow six arms again? Am I still sick from that enzyme from Morbius's blood or whatever? Nope, you just have an ulcer, dude. And he's like, you just can't catch a break. And I was a little bit harsh on Peter in our last outing here in ASM with our dear friend, the Gibbon, who we all have in our life.
What was up?
Well,
damn it, Tim.
You were going to say?
What was up? We'll talk about it later. Never mind. Just go ahead.
Okay. But that, having said that, Amazing Spider-Man is at its best as a comic when our hero just has his back to the wall, physically and mentally, emotionally spent. And this story just really employs that classic formula. So I don't know that the writing on this from Jerry Conway is the best Jerry Conway writing we've seen. I kind of wonder if we would be as complimentary as we've had towards Conway if this was our only real exposure to him. But he gets the job done, certainly. I'm not wild about Doc Ock's depiction as this sort of cunning criminal mastermind with all these resources and this like safe house that's equipped with booby traps and
safe mansion, essentially.
Safe mansion, yeah. That's, I don't know. It's a lot. And yeah, lastly, the whole Aunt May of it all, where she is such a dingbat. I mean, she really, like, isn't his identity, isn't Doc Ock's identity public? Like, the guy who used to be her boarder, who is now her host and, I guess, employer and lover, which we don't speak of, who his name is Dr. Otto Octavius, and he has four mechanical metal arms, and he looks just like this guy called Dr. Octopus that's been all over the news, but there can't be anything off about this guy, right? He's a nice, sweet man. It's really pushing it. Like, you almost think, like, you start to get concerned that there's maybe some kind of mental issue going on with her. So, yeah, I hope she's out of the book for a while, ultimately. And I don't know if that's the case. I haven't read a lot of this era of Spider-Man, but I would like to be done with Aunt May for just a bit after this story, because that was wow, wow.
Man, shocking words from you, Tim, taking Aunt May to task, but it's time for me to deliver some shocking words of my own. Because next up on our list for discussion is Avengers 102 through 104. And now I think we all, I myself and the rest of us, we've been very hard on the Avengers title it, pretty much any time it's popped up on our reading list. I have made the statement that I believe the Avengers have yet to have a good story throughout the first 11 years of their history. Not that I've read anyway. And then comes along Avengers 102. And while they still haven't delivered a completely good story, at least they gave me half of one. The first 10 pages of Avengers 102, I would say, are really good. Where we get the Grim Reaper kind of tempting the Vision with the opportunity to be human and the opportunity to fully embrace his love for Wanda if he will only betray the other Avengers. And it's a great idea for a story. It's a great way to seed a story. And then they proceed to essentially ignore and neglect that great seed for what is the remaining 10 pages of this issue and then two issues that follow, and give us this really weird Sentinel story where they reveal that, like, Larry Trask, the son of Bolivar Trask, was also a mutant and yada, 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 and no one gives a flying fuck. Three issues, the first 10 pages are the only thing interesting about it. Todd, your thoughts here.
That's exactly what I was going to say, word for word. Next.
Awesome.
No, I agree with you about the Vision stuff, but I think you may be overselling a little bit. It was at least interesting and compelling, and you get Hawkeye being a douche. And
here's what I like about it. I think Avengers is a book. It's an ensemble book where so many of the characters are written interchangeably. And the Vision is really the only character I've seen to date that Roy Thomas or anyone else is able to distinguish from the other characters. So it makes it unique, and it gives it a different voice, and it makes you care about this character because he's not interchangeable with Hawkeye or Captain America or anyone else.
I agree. I like just the kind of the tension with Wanda, and the rest of it, though, is poop. It really is. And Rich Buckler is kind of a boring artist to me. It's just very blah art, even though I have heard people online and in some of the groups I belong to, like Back Issue Magazine group, praise him. But I don't get it, because this is really blah stuff for me. And the Sentinel story got kind of ridiculous after a while. And Quicksilver, oh my goodness, Quicksilver can go take a leap because he's a jerk. He really is. He deserves.
It just felt like a one-issue story that was stretched into three issues, by the way, the Sentinel stuff.
Although, fooling the Sentinels into killing one of their own and then all falling down, that's a great ending. It really is. Hats off to you, Roy Thomas.
Jesus Christ. Tim, your thoughts here? I mean, this is, after all, as it says in 102, from an idea suggested by Chris Claremont, so I'm pretty sure you're legally required to like this.
I am. I don't love this, but I...
Oh, Rick Jones. Said, gosh, dang it.
Oh,
my
yeah.
God, yeah, I forgot he popped up here bitching about being left out again, even though at this point, didn't he not have power? So what the hell is he going to do? Like, just stand there and be annoying again?
It was almost like that the is comic his power. Gods... It was almost like the gods of comics knew that we were almost about to say something nice about an Avengers story by Roy Thomas, and they were like, get Rick Jones out there now. And
get me Rick Jones stat.
That just sunk it. That just really killed it for us.
Because 47 years from now, these dudes on a podcast are going to almost compliment an Avengers book.
That's right.
Almost.
They're all knowing and all seeing, the gods of comics. Okay, so based on an idea by Chris Claremont, the idea that they're referring to is from the Sentinel story that this Avengers story frequently calls back to, which we did not read. It was that Neil Adams introductory issue on X-Men that drove me over the edge because it wasn't on our list, sadly, in the 60s. But it was a very good story, and the idea is contributed by Chris Claremont was the Sentinels, it's pretty goofy, would be defeated by a logic trap, which is Cyclops essentially arguing with them and saying, well, you know, if you are really serious about this whole extinguishing the threat of mutant kind forever, you have to really tackle mutancy at its source, and that would be the Earth's sun. So you have to basically destroy the sun in order to ensure that mutants will never be a thing anymore.
As you will.
As you will. And the Sentinel said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So they took off in orbit and presumably were destroyed by literally flying too close to the sun. Evidently, Roy Thomas decided these Sentinels were not destroyed and brings them back here. So he's kind of, one-upping that weird idea, that weird concept by Chris Claremont and saying, no, the Sentinels weren't destroyed. One of them actually mutated and in an ironic twist is now itself a mutant, which its compatriots then detect and destroy. So I guess one crazy idea deserves another here in the mind of Roy Thomas, because he loves doing these callbacks to all these earlier stories. Again, think it might have helped had we read that X-Men tale, but that's just the X-Men mark in me, I guess. I had some of the same observations that you guys did as far as that first half of 102 being kind of halfway decent. And I think what it is that Roy Thomas isn't terrible when he actually is engaging with the characters, when he's leaning into those sort of natural interpersonal dynamics without the burden of this big physical threat, like a big stupid fight scene. Because when that happens, he does this thing where he just cranks up the melodrama, like in the midst of an action scene, and the characterization just really starts to unravel. It's all this just forced conflict. He makes everybody act really irrational and just childish and the way that they react to each other. They're just imbeciles, right? During this fight scene where they start squabbling. And that's like pretty much been the story of his Avengers, I think. Mm-hmm. But when we have, Hawkeye kind of acting like a chode and the narration sort of calling him out on that, and him realizing it himself, there's sort of something to work with there. We don't ride with that enough, I don't think, because there's just like, and now fight scene. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot here that I think could have just been told over one or perhaps two issues, because there are things happening, but it's stretched across a fairly thin story. And I was kind of okay with the art by Rich Buckler, I would say. I think I was sort of welcoming a break from that Roy Thomas, John Buscema formula. I think it was just the writing was certainly wearing thin a long time ago, but just to mix it up visually, I was okay with Buckler. He has that sort of interesting diagram that he does just vertically down the page, and I think it was 104 where they were in the Sentinel compound. But
he does a lot.
Right. That's sort of his thing, right? So, and this is
the diagram bit?
This is not the first time we saw him. We saw him on that Man-Thing story in the Fear anthology last time around.
So a couple of questions, and I'll start with the more difficult one first. Tim, if you were Wanda, would you have been able to resist Hawkeye's advances in that outfit?
Well, perhaps not in that outfit. But,
The thigh-high skirt, you know, the deep plunge V-neck, you know.
Yeah, the fuck me boots.
Yeah. Man. I mean, it's all – he's got the whole ensemble here.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, not going to lie. He opens his mouth and you're just sort of like, ugh. But then you look at that outfit, it just gets you going.
There you go.
I'll tell you who I really could not resist if he made romantic advances on me, and that is Dr. Super Astronaut Director Peter Corbeau, who is the head of StarCorps. And, man, he's going to turn up a lot here in the 70s.
Oh, joy.
Yeah, I think he appeared already in, like, an issue of Hulk not too long before this. First time we've seen him, and get used to him. Learn to love him. He's great.
A more legitimate question. Many years ago when I did my own solo Thor reading project, I read a bunch of Avengers that had Thor in it because I was trying to read every appearance of Thor from his introduction up through the modern day. And I made it all the way until Eric Masterson, and then it killed my will to live nearly. Remind me, when does Englehart take over Avengers? Because I feel like that's got to be relatively strong.
Next issue.
Really?
Yeah, this is it for Roy Thomas.
We're done. because much to – I know Ben Morris is gonna love me saying this. I do remember enjoying the Englehart Avengers, but I think mainly because he leaned into the Vision stuff a lot. And again, he's the only character I'm really finding interesting in this run to this point. So I'm looking forward to revisiting that because I do have somewhat fond memories of that from about a decade ago whenever I read those books. Russell, you haven't weighed in here on Avengers 102 through 104. Your thoughts, anything redeeming here outside of the Vision stuff?
Roy Thomas has come to it and decided to introduce us to his number two. His name? Number two. And, oh, he certainly dropped a deuce.
He
in
looks
this
like
book.
A big pile of number two.
Yep. Yeah. He that's what I was saying. Like, he dropped a big deuce on this entire story. As Nick pointed out, the first few pages are like, oh, this is an interesting plot idea if stilted by, again, awful dialogue because Roy Thomas has no fucking clue how to give any character a unique voice. And then we get into the rest of the book, and it's like, hey, there's Hawkeye having yet another Me Too moment with Scarlet Witch. Congratulations on that wardrobe choice. I'm going to keep the streak alive. This is trash. This is absolute pure trash. And despite the one good concept that Roy Thomas stumbled upon here, we have his ham-fisted, just clumsy Icarus call out here with the Sentinel that flew too close to the sun and mutated.
That's right.
A machine flew too close to the sun and is now a mutant.
You say that's too on the news?
I'm saying that I can't believe this is still canon because it still is. There is indeed a sentient Sentinel that is
– Russell, Todd, do you guys not recall just a few months back the let's just say a Sentinel-like thing in current X-Men comics by Jonathan Hickman got ejected into the sun not too terribly long ago.
Yes, and I was like, there we go, ejected into the sun. I guarantee you that is not going to mutate. That's just going to melt. It better not. It better fucking not. It better not mutate.
You guys are missing the whole thing because this is all about the Vision and him seeing what happens when you fly too close to the sun / vagina.
It's a... This is where we are.
Black hole sun, indeed.
How dare you invoke the great Chris Cornell in this? I am personally offended.
I had to bring home the vagina sun comparison.
Yeah, you really did.
I mean, we've already invoked Chris Claremont and Jonathan Hickman. So
two writers that are vastly more talented than the person who put this together. And my God, if they don't stop calling each other Avenger, I'm just going to start smashing my own tablet having to read that. It's that is just too much for me. It's like, why? Nobody talked like that. Nobody even in the 70s talked like that. Where is Roy Thomas getting this? I don't get it. Like Nick said, there's one good concept in this book. It is completely wasted. This is not for me. I can't wait for Avengers to get good, but if I were, you know, a comic book reader in the 70s and this is what Avengers was offering up, I'd probably be wondering why this book hasn't been canceled yet. So that's
Cap says all when he says, let's just all forget this. Let's bury it at the very end.
Yeah.
I was like, let's just move on.
Let's just bury this book and be done with it.
Let's crush it like Larry Trask getting squashed like an insect under a toppling sentinel, which I found unintentionally darkly hilarious.
Second most interesting thing that happened in this story.
God, what a useless character that Larry Trask was.
And his housemate.
Don't forget his house. Yes. What is this weird relationship between him and the judge? Like, that is very okay.
Keto.
God. I also thought it was weird that we had two characters with mysterious amulets in the same story that were just totally unconnected. That's an interesting choice, Roy Thomas.
Two things that don't go in the same sentence together. Interesting choice and Roy Thomas.
There you go. All right, let's move on and let's talk about a book that I think is arguably worse than Avengers. And what now?
You can't mean that.
I think I kind of do. Like, and here's, you know, in full disclosure, I often wait until the day of these podcasts to read the bulk of our reading list, and I do it so that I can pretend like it's all be fresher for the podcast, but really it's because I'm a terrible procrastinator, and that's just the person that I am, and I have to come to accept it. And what winds up happening is I can usually judge a book's quality by how much attention I am actually paying as I read it. And Avengers, as bad as it has been and as bad as it was, I was interested enough in the Vision stuff and kind of, you know, just watching the plot play out that I read that fairly closely. This Warlock thing, I read three issues of this and I couldn't tell you the first fucking thing about it. My God, this is awful. Like, is there an interesting character in this book? Because it ain't Adam Warlock. It's not his four little groupies. And it's certainly not the high AF evolutionary. Like, there's nothing interesting here. The art is kind of cool, like kind of nice to look at. But other than that, I hate all the characters in this book. I wish Counter-Earth would just get nuclear bombed off the, you know, out of the solar system. Roy Thomas is just the dirt fucking worst. Is what it's coming to. Like, I mean, between Avengers,
is he wrong?
Good God, man! Good God,
you are not wrong.
Go ahead, Russell. You talk about it, then you might remember it better than I did. Well, and I read it today.
Oh, permit me to sneer and grasp my scepter. The high AF evolutionary can't make up his mind on any fucking thing, except that he's real bored and he's going to call Adam Warlock away at random ass moments just to lay on some exposition to you, because yet again, Marvel has launched a brand new ongoing series in the middle of a fucking story arc. Congratulations. This is a great idea. We're just going to like throw in all the exposition we possibly can and you're going to read it. Even if you've been reading The Adventures of Adam Warlock up to now, but, you know, since it's a number one, we got to tell everybody what's happened up to now. Good God, this dumb. This is real fucking dumb. And yet, and Nick correctly called out, there is not one interesting character in this book. And it is a special achievement. Roy Thomas, take your trophy. You have managed to create a character who is, in fact, more boring than Captain Marvel. That is special. I mean, who the fuck is reading this in the 70s? Anybody, please. And then Mike Friedrich comes along to script issue the second and third issues. It gets marginally better, but that's, you know, what a low bar to clear that is. This is absolute trash. There is no reason anybody should ever read this. I hate myself for having read it. So just thank you for putting this on the list, Tim. This is what I needed, some more self-loathing. But you know what? Nobody loathes themselves more than Adam Warlock hates himself.
Is this the book, by the way? And again, they've started to run together a little bit in my head because, again, I read them all today. Don't we get another mention of a Given in this Warlock book when, like, I had never heard the word Given, I think, used in this context until our last episode. And now I know a Given's a giant fucking monkey. And the second time in two episodes, they worked that shit in. Who had a Given obsession at Marvel at this
Roy
point
Thomas.
In 1972?
Roy Thomas definitely did.
Jerry Conway did the first Given, right?
So, yeah.
And Roy Thomas was his editor.
There you go. Tim?
It's all about the soul gem, isn't it? That's why we read these, because there is a soul gem on his
Tim, yeah, you built the list. Why did we read these?
We also read these because there's only like – granted, I know this is a lot. It's not a lot, but it sounds like it is given the quality. But – there's like six issues of Warlock before it turns into the Warlock that we actually know and recognize. I thought it might be a good idea to get a somewhat of a decent grounding in the character, just in his origins and how he was reinvented, how the Soul Gem comes into the picture. The stuff with Counter-Earth is not that important in the grand scheme of things for him, but it is a kind of long-running Marvel concept.
Recently referred to on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Indeed.
Yes, along with
the animated series Spider-Man Unlimited.
The high AF evolutionary. And I guess his deal is just going, hey, Adam, what you doing? You making friends? You having a good time?
Should I destroy Earth?
destroy the Earth? No? You don't want me to? All right. Well, how about now? No? All right. I'll leave you alone. And that just sort of repeats over the first two issues here. And I don't know. I guess I don't think this is as bad as Avengers because it doesn't have nearly such lofty expectations to plummet from. I mean, keep in mind, Avengers right now, there's a movie based on called Avengers that is the highest grossing film worldwide of all time right now. And yet, when you go back and look at Avengers comics, you look at, well, what's the basis for this? How did we get here? Like, what's the foundations? And let me really dive into some Avengers and see what the appeal is, why it became this global phenomenon. And you read 1970s Avengers comics, and you're like, what? What is happening? Versus something like Warlock, which I don't really have any expectations when it comes to this type of character that we've had so little exposure to. And I do think Thomas is a little bit better on solo characters than he is like on a team book, because he's infusing this with his kind of typical weirdness. It's not good weird, but it's at least half or could be interesting weird, but it comes off so dry that first issue. And so I was like, okay, easy to put that down, move on. I think Mike Friedrich, not to be confused with Gary Friedrich, by the way, who also writes an issue we're going to be talking about soon, and Gary Friedrich, who also wrote the All Lives Matter issue of Captain America, no relation between these two, evidently. So anyway, yeah, two writers in the 70s Marvel stable, last name Friedrich, but this is Mike, who sexes it up a little bit with issues 2 and 3. I like that issue 2 has Warlock just destroying the planet. Nick, you said you wanted to see Counter-Earth just nuked, and we kind of got that in issue 2. I mean, they walk it back, but it's still fun to see, like, visually. So it has that going for it, at least. But at the end of the day, it's just really weighed down by the premise, which I don't know what the premise is. Like, Warlock has been refashioned as this kind of Christ-like savior figure, but he's going to save this counter-Earth that is just in opposite rotation of our Earth, and the high evolutionary is freaking out because it's going to get discovered, and yet he didn't think of this before he made the damn thing. It's just, you can't really work with that, I don't think. It feels very half-baked. So I will be looking forward to us moving on from this particular concept, which will be happening in a few issues' time. This series, I trust, will find its footing, just sort of kind of knowing what's on the horizon here. And I guess that's all I'll say.
Todd, tell us your thoughts here on Warlock, or am I taking it a bit too far by saying this is worse than Avengers?
You know, that's like saying Santa with muscles is just a little bit worse than Thunder in Paradise. You know, we're talking apples and oranges and diminished versus raised expectations.
And in that scenario, both are wonderful.
Neither are wonderful.
Until you've seen Hulk Hogan's partner in Thunder in Paradise have a fantasy dream sequence about a harem on network television, sir. You've not lived.
Well, for argument's sake, let's call this Thunder in Paradise, because this is weird, but not yet interesting enough to be entertaining weird, or you know what I mean? I wish it was just a little bit weirder.
This is not a sound comparison. I don't agree with it at all. Right.
Well, I'm trying to get some kind of relevance to you, because this is not good comics by any means. It's weird. I keep saying that adjective, but it's the truth. And there's this strange obsession with beast people or animal people, and the Christ metaphor, the prophet in the first issue who turned out to be the bad guy all along. There's some kind of connection with the Marvel Universe as a whole with the high AF evolutionary, but otherwise this is kind of in its own place, its own continuity, if you will. And I don't know if these are significant at all, but like Tim says, better things are happening on the horizon. Jim Starlin is going to get cosmic here pretty soon, so let's just kind of hang in there until that day, because this is skippable to me.
Couldn't we be doing the same things with Adam Warlock, this Adam Warlock, as the Silver Surfer?
Yeah.
Like, if you stuck Silver Surfer in this story instead of Warlock, number one, it'd be better, and you could tell virtually the same story.
Right.
And plus, we've kind of seen that same story from Silver Surfer issues.
You would have an interesting backstory and, you know, a reason to care with the threat of Galactus / you know, the quest for Shalabal always there. Yeah. And I don't care about Warlock and his weird goldness.
So, and that's just a huge problem when your protagonist is that interchangeable with another character that you can draw that line so easily.
Absolutely. Moving on from Warlock, mercifully, let's move over to the last book we're going to talk about before we take a break, and that is Marvel Spotlight. And this is another of these anthology titles that's being used to set up a variety of different characters and concepts. And here in Marvel Spotlight number 5, published in August of 1972, we're going to see the debut of Johnny Blaze, a.k.a. Ghost Rider, created here by Gary Friedrich, who came up with the idea, and the art is from Mike Ploog. And, okay, let me say this from the jump. Very few of these 1972 Marvel books are able to exercise subtlety in their storytelling. So we have to kind of come into this with that understanding, that nothing is overly subtle in 1972 Marvel. That being said, despite the lack of subtlety in this story, I kind of wound up liking it. I think because it was just a little bit different. It's kind of like the Werewolf by Night and the Man-Thing stuff that we read, where they're injecting, or the Tomb of Dracula stuff, where they're injecting a little bit of this horror vibe into the Marvel Universe. And Johnny Blaze, at this point, is certainly not the Ghost Rider, a fully formed version of Ghost Rider that we will come to know over the years. But I don't know, just something about this story, the way it was drawn, the way the character set up, kind of this all, you know, this quick, breezy, short version of the origin, kind of just introducing us to this character. I wound up liking it. I'm a little intrigued, and I kind of want to see more. I don't really know if there are any more important Ghost Rider stories that are told in the 1970s that would warrant inclusion on our list, but if this is our one little snapshot, I'm pretty pleased with what we got. Tim, you put this on the list, or you at least decided to keep it on the list, perhaps. What were your thoughts here?
Sort of similar, around the same lines. It felt very pulpy. And
right.
In the sense that it just really goes for it. This is a story that has a very good sense of identity. It knows what it is, and it's pretty shameless about what it is. And you talk about the lack of subtlety, and I guess I should just come out and say it. This takes an abrupt turn towards Satanism. There's no build to this. There's no foreshadowing whatsoever. It's just he learns a guy is sick. Let me ask you guys this. When you receive bad news, or you know that something bad is about to happen, is turning to Satanism, making a deal with the devil, your first or second course of action? Because we very much get the sense that it is Johnny Blaze's first. And you're like, well, I guess that's what we're doing here. And sure enough, when you make a deal with the devil, you kind of get double-crossed. And I laughed and laughed and laughed when – what's the guy's name? Crash Simpson. When he wipes out, I lost it.
And what about so in addition to Johnny not having like them building to Johnny knowing about, you know, turning to Satanism, what about the fact that Roxanne all of a sudden pops up and knows how to like ward off a demon with an incantation like out of nowhere? Whole thing was pretty funny.
I mean, you just get a sense that this is what people did in the '70s. It's, you know, it's
sat around and read books about Satanism.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's just a thing. And man, it's asking a lot with these sort of leaps in logic, but I kind of don't care. It is what Warlock isn't. It's entertaining in how kind of goofy it is. But I think, as our friend Todd Weber put it, this is some straight up Satan shit right here.
Todd did put it that way. Todd, your thoughts here on the debut of Ghost Rider?
This is some straight up Satan shit right here. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah, they don't couch it with like Mephisto or something like that. It's Satan.
It's right. Yeah, we don't get the stand-in. We don't get Mephisto. It's just,
I mean, just it's Satan. Cattle. it just takes a turn, like you said, out of the blue. And yet, this was very fun to read, almost ironically, I suppose. But even then, I enjoyed it just because. Yeah. Modern sensibilities. I'd never read Ghost Rider's origin. I just always assumed it was something like this, but not quite as bucolic, I think, with the traveling family. and Satan. And, you know, he finds this goat skull. He's got the blood. He's got a pentagram. He's got this library full of books about Satan. And his girlfriend certainly is prepared. Just in case. Just, I suspected you'd made a deal with the devil. Back of Alex Edison of the Depths. Just kind of matter-of-factly, she rebukes Satan. But then she breaks up with Johnny and leaves. And Johnny is now Ghost Rider, and he's going to fight crime, I guess. So there you have it. Great character design. Very striking looking. Of course, there had been a Ghost Rider in the Western days, I believe. But so they're using that trademark again. But a good update. Interesting to see what will happen with Ghost Rider in the future. But I'm glad we read this too, because this was certainly the most fun I had reading a book this month.
Awesome. Russell, your thoughts?
Satan.
When you need a friend, there's nobody quite like Satan.
Satan.
Like your adoptive father has gotten the disease and has lost all faith in you. Your sister lover has decided that you're a coward. You can't really find the strength to go on. So
if we're going to accept it with Barry and Iris on the phone, we've got to accept it here with Johnny.
I'm not saying. I'm just saying that this is more bonkers than the Nick Cage movie. So that the Nick Cage movie is toned down from the actual comic book source material is really saying something. We have struck a form of gold. I'm not sure what I'm going to call it yet, but it is. This was not boring bad. This was bad, but it was not boring. It was never boring. And yes, we have to remark again on the hilarity of a guy named Crash, indeed, crashing his motorcycle. He's a stuntman, and it goes horribly wrong. Who would have thought? But, you know, where this book goes wrong for me, though, is in the whole Hail Satan moment. That's where I was cackling at how just absurd it is. But – It just keeps going off the rails. I mean, to its credit, it's like, you know what? I'm going off the rails right here, and I'm just going to take this train all the way off. We're not even breaking a little bit. Fuck that. We're just going to go for it.
You know what's great about the Satan character in this book? Was I the only person who, when like Johnny Blaze leaves to go confront Satan, he's like, hey, wait a minute. I told you if you'd save the old man, I'd be yours forever. And he's like, well, I did save him from the disease. And you as the reader kind of go, well, Satan's got a point there.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. It's like Satan did exactly what he was said, but you know, the old man did kill himself. But what I was expecting was something, I guess, a little more conventional in that he was being called a coward. Everybody's walking out of his life, and Johnny Blaze was going to do something along the lines of, I'm going to go out there and perform this stunt, nearly get himself killed, and in a bit of a you know, what I guess we could say is a Spawn-esque type situation, he winds up fucking himself up, and the devil comes to him and is like, hey, I could help you out there. You're looking a little rough shape, having a bad day, but maybe I help you out with a little cleanup, a little redo, just for the cost of your measly soul. But nah, Johnny Blaze is apparently a full-on devil worshiper, and there is no setup for that whatsoever. It's just, you're reading along, this is all going wrong, you're feeling kind of bad for the dude, and then, well, fucking Hail Satan, there it is. Just in one panel, he gets to this. And then, of course, his sister lover knows how to ward off the devil, because of course she does. And it was not a deal breaker for her. I mean, that is love. She finds all your books on Satan. She reads up on them and learns how to save your soul rather than, you know, just saying, eh, maybe this isn't the dude for me. Maybe this is a bit of a red flag. You would think even in that situation, they are carnies after all, that this would have been a little bit of a warning sign, but nope, she's all in on this Johnny Blaze guy until she isn't, and then she is again, and then she's not. This book cannot find a consistent through line for its characters. It is just absolutely fucking insane, and it's worth at least one look. So give it a shot, but be prepared for insanity, because that's all I can describe this book as.
But I would say, yeah, absolutely. It owes more than a little to the Werewolf by Night.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's the same kind of diary.
There is an obsession at Marvel at this point with people who transform from one creature or from like normal to a creature in the night. First Hulk did it, and then we have Werewolf by Night, and now we have Ghost Rider. This is going to be a thing.
I'm interested to see when this kind of shifts from, you know, just it being another Werewolf by Night or Hulk knockoff to the actual Spirit of Vengeance idea, which isn't even touched upon in this initial origin. So, I mean, perhaps we'll see some more Ghost Rider on our list. I don't know.
Well, it's even kind of the same character model almost as Jack Russell here with Johnny Blaze. They look very – and then same artist, Mike Pluge. That is very – I don't know. That may relate to something that I will get to at the end here. But yeah, I mean, this is one of those, I don't know that it cares that it is lacking in a lot of internal logic. It just sort of, like I said, it just sort of goes for it. And it read to me like one of those old one of those old like short stories in a horror anthology type of thing. That maybe this wouldn't be an ongoing character, an ongoing series, but for a one-off, like, here you go.
Right. Well, with all that being said, I think it's time for us to take a break. But stick with us. When we come back, we're going to talk some Daredevil, some Defenders, some Captain America, a new character called the Cat, and because it's the end of our 1972 discussion, we're going to throw out our year-end awards. So stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. In the Place to be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, Marvel Age listeners, it's your manager, Todd Weber, here to tell you about the latest happenings on Place to Be Nation, Hop, the podcast feed, as well as our wrestling feed and our website, PlaceToBeNation.com. Hey, first up, on the Pop feed, we've got weekly shows Monday through Friday. That's right. My dream of a new show every day has been achieved. Every Monday, we've got the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast, currently watching The Office. They just watched episodes 9 and 10 of season 4 of The Office, including the greatest episode of all time, in my opinion, Dinner Party. Just one night, you made everything feel all right. Every Tuesday, we've got Diamond Conversations with Chad B. This week, he talked to Walt Friedman from Summer Games Books. On Wednesdays, we've got It Was a Thing on TV, another new show about TV. Latest show had Mike and Greg talking about Match Game and Hollywood Squares revival, short-lived, early in the 80s, and then they watched a show called Mr. Smith, a very hyped show that did not last. Every Thursday, we've got a couple shows. We've got This Week in the NFL, while the NFL season is still going. We've also got whatever Andy Atherton is purveying. That includes all of his shows, which are The Great Debate, Looking Forward, Looking Back, Laugh in Theater, and The Year in Pop. Fridays are, of course, the home of the hard-traveling fanboys. Your weekly episodic, yeah, them. We've also got lots of other great shows, including Glenn Butler Podcast Hour, Spectacular, and others. Be sure to check out the wrestling feed. Includes a deep dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes BTB Podcast, Main Event, Wrestling Warzone, Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, and much, much more. Subscribe to that feed as well. We have a spin-off feed called The Jenny Position, Jennifer Smith's shows, her family, Geek and Sassy Talking Pop, Freak Out Driving and Telling Stories, plus much more. Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament is taking place now on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Check it out. We're in round one. People are getting hurt feelings all the time, but that's the way these tournaments go. We've also got our 2020 stretch project determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have to research and nominate. Of course, the greatest match of all time from WCW is Halloween Havoc 1997, Guerrero Mysterio. But there will be a 99 other ones to read about. Eventually, nominate. Get into it. Refresh PlaceToBeNation.com every day. We've got articles, all all our podcast links, all kinds of stuff, every single day. Click on our banner at placetobenation.com/Amazon. It's also on our homepage. It takes you right to Amazon. Buy your Depends undergarments and whatever you need to, and it helps us out. Continue to check out the archives of our feeds for tons of great content. But we're going to get back to the Marvel Age podcast right now.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation listeners, to the Marvel Age podcast. We hope you enjoyed that little sneak preview of all the different shows you can find across both feeds. But for now, let's jump right back into our discussion of 1972 in Marvel Comics. And let's check back in with the man without fear. That, of course, being Matt Murdock, a.k.a. Daredevil, in the pages of Daredevil 90 and 91. We've read some Daredevil throughout, you know, checked in on him a couple of times in his new status quo in San Francisco in 1972. Now shacking up with the Black Widow. Good for him. And here again, we've got some – it's a Jerry Conway story. It's Gene Colan on art, and we're continuing to unravel the mystery of what exactly is going on with Natasha and this guy named Danny French. We get a little bit of a flashback here to one of her earliest spy missions. We also get the introduction of a reimagined version of Mr. Fear, one of Daredevil's classic villains. And I don't know – what it is really about this San Francisco chapter of Daredevil's existence that has kind of hooked me in from the jump from when we first checked in with him here in 72. I think it might be the Gene Colan art. It seems to fit Daredevil so well. It's got a little bit of a shadowy quality to it, and it just looks a little bit different than the other stuff we're seeing from the Marvel superhero pantheon. I know Gene Colan has done some other stuff here in 72, predominantly some of the horror comics that I'm thinking of, but something about these Daredevil issues is just clicking for me. I wound up really, really enjoying this. Tim, I know you're a massive Daredevil fan. What were your thoughts here?
More of the same, really. I'm glad we're sort of continuing this little check-in, this mini check-in with Daredevil, who we haven't seen on our reading list for much, really, any of the 70s up until this point. And how this book has just improved by leaps and bounds. We talked about how ridiculous that Marvel Spotlight Ghost Rider debut story was. And that almost – you can compare that to some of the early Daredevil that we read just in terms of sheer goofiness, where it's bad but entertainingly bad. And Daredevil is now developed into this very kind of serious title, very well written with – art that perfectly suits the story, and can't ask for a whole lot more than that in your serialized superhero storytelling. I am more interested in this secrets of Danny French, and we don't actually get the whole story here. We get a bit of it in that Black Widow flashback, but more interested in that as I feel like I ought to be, or that I might be in the hands of a lesser writer. But Jerry Conway's really keeping me on the hook here. Don't know that the Gene Colan art in these two issues was quite as striking or distinctive as we've seen from him in the past. These are kind of cleaner lines, more conventional, but not in a bad way at all. I wonder if that was just kind of a deadline issue where he was a bit rushed, or if there was an actual editorial directive to do things differently. I don't know. But I always like that, especially on this series. It feels like every scene under the hand of Gene Colan, like, is either taking place at twilight or like in the early morning sunrise dawn hours. If it's not, you know, explicitly at night, there's just this weird kind of glow. And a lot of that is credit to the colorist, I know, but just what he does with shadow and lighting and just angles is very, very different. He's totally, totally set apart from, you know, his peers here in this Marvel bullpen of the early 70s. And as for the story, it's nothing special. Mr. Fear, okay, great kind of one-off use of a villain callback to earlier Daredevil stuff, apparently. I mean, this is where we're seeing these creators who are fans of the characters, like, reading in the formative years of the Marvel Universe, now becoming professionals. So they're sort of continuity junkies here. And Jerry Conway, who's still, as was mentioned before, very young. Same deal with Steve Englehart, who we're going to be seeing here soon as well, and who we've seen before on that Amazing Adventures anthology book with Beast. So that's going to be a recurring theme. We see a lot of it from Conway. We certainly see it in this story. And, yeah, I don't know how much more we're going to be sticking with this series. I know that they've got an anniversary coming up, closing in on issue 100. So that's certainly a stay tuned.
Awesome. Good to hear. Todd, your thoughts on this Daredevil story?
I must say, I read this two times, and the first time I read it page to page because I tend to speed read that way. And I had some extra time, so I read it panel to panel, which is a feature you can do on Marvel Unlimited. And I tell you what, panel to panel, it read very, very contemporary to me. I just felt so much ahead of something like Fantastic Four or Avengers. Just it felt like a state-of-the-art for 1972 comic in a good way. Both the art, the story. Conway, you know, he wrote Peter Parker in such a contemporary manner. Well, here he's writing more sophisticated people, more sophisticated lives, more mature problems, but still very relevant and contemporary. Gene Colan's art is even better in panel to panel, I think. But remember that he's doing Dracula at this point, so maybe he's having to rush just a little bit through it. Still, what a breath of fresh air this run has been. I'm glad we've gotten to read these. The book only sags to me when the gaudy Mr. Fear character is introduced, and even that's just kind of a short-term thing where you have this character that presented as an opposite to the man with fear or without fear. And you also had these shady lawyers trying to recruit Matt Murdock. So you had the law story, you had Natasha's fashion stuff, plus her flashbacks with Danny French and her Russian spy training, Ivan being Ivan, and Daredevil, and the cops maintaining this antagonistic relationship. So all in all, very good stuff. I thought once you got the kind of goofy-looking villain into it, it took me out of the story. But that's just me. I don't know. What did you think, Russell?
I was actually kind of into the whole Mr. Fear thing. I thought that it was nice to have a masked supervillain for Daredevil to take on, because that was something that the series has been dealing with, but the villains they were dealing with were things like Electro, and he was being handled in his usual kind of goofy manner, because I find Electro to be a pretty goofy style villain. But I think the idea of Mr. Fear is actually pretty good, because Daredevil is called the Man Without Fear. Well, this guy gets in his head, and just like he gets inside a Black Widow's head and makes them like have this panic attack, basically. So that's pretty good stuff to me. Now, like everybody else has been calling out, the Gene Colan art is phenomenal. This is some of the best-looking comics that we've read up to this point. I am a big fan of what's happening here with Daredevil. Jerry Conway is for sure the right person to be handling this book. He's doing a killer job with Matt Murdock. I am really enjoying the San Francisco stuff. As someone who read the entirety of Mark Waid's run on Daredevil, it's nice for me to read this, which I believe is Matt's like first real time, like just taking up residence in San Francisco, and seeing all these callbacks that Mark Waid was putting into his run. This is pretty classic stuff. I think this really makes Daredevil arguably the most consistent book that we're reading as part of our list, because it's after a certain point, it's really just taken on a pretty strong stance. Like it knows who it is. There's no struggle for identity here. Daredevil is becoming a bit more gritty as we go along, but it's perfectly suited for that. This is the kind of book that you want something like that to be in. I do take issue with a couple of things in these two issues. Some of the handling of Black Widow, and especially the way Matt talks to her, the way other characters talk to her is pretty misogynistic, even for the day. And it only gets a little uncomfortable here and there. Some of the dialogue is not quite up to snuff to me as some of Jerry Conway's other work, see Amazing Spider-Man. But overall, this is really strong. It's very well handled. Strong couple of issues that I felt like really continued to build up that mystery, as you guys talked about with Danny French. We get a few answers here, some more of his background, but we're still left hanging. We're still not getting the full picture of him. What is this project for that they keep talking about? That's something that we also didn't. I don't feel like we got like a full answer for. There's more to this mystery, and Jerry Conway has baited the hook properly because it is firmly set in my gills, I guess, because I'm all in for coming back for more. Tim, I hope you keep putting Daredevil on the list.
I think I am.
Good. Can't wait to see what happens.
We all seem to enjoy it, so why not?
It's a really great palate cleanser after we hailed Satan.
Outstanding. Well, moving on to
Devil. Yes, this is the devil I like.
There we go. Well, let's move on to Defenders, which is,
speaking of things I liked,
a concept that we have seen in the pages of, I think it was Marvel Feature, Marvel Feature.
Yep.
And here they're spinning out into their own solo, or not solo title, but their own dedicated series as we read the first three issues of the Defenders ongoing comic. Again, this is Hulk, Doctor Strange, Namor, and Silver Surfer together under the penmanship of Steve Englehart with art from, who's got it? Sal Buscema.
Sal Buscema.
So
the great Sal Buscema.
I don't know that I necessarily loved this, but on a reading list where there are only two team books on here and one of them is Roy Thomas's Avengers, that makes this look like a work of fucking genius compared to that. So for being readable, at least, I wound up appreciating this more than it probably deserved. It was fine in its own right. I feel like there are bigger and better things to come for Steve Englehart as we track here his progress here in Marvel in the 1970s. Russell, I know you said you liked it a lot. Well, what'd you like about it?
First of all, Steve Englehart gets how to write Hulk. He made Hulk.
Yeah, he is really good.
Funny, like he understood this is how you make Hulk relatable in these books. You steer into the comedy aspect of it. That's why I really wound up liking this a lot. That, and I appreciated the way that he wrote Namor and Doctor Strange. He's mixing in a really good bit of comedy, like I said, but that's what makes the like more serious moments kind of stand out. And typically, I'm not into books that steer heavy into mysticism, magic, stuff like that. That's not really for me. But the way Englehart frames it, it kind of simplifies things a little bit to me. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to like put in a whole bunch of, or at least one little callback to a story that happened a while back, but that's only in issue one. Like you really get like most of your exposition there, and then Englehart's like, okay, that's all we need. We're going to move on. Some pretty fun stuff all around. Like everybody gets a moment to shine. Namor, you know, whenever he's finally in the book, like whenever he's finally like taking up a moment in the book, he gets a kind of a big hero moment. Even Bruce Banner gets a big hero moment in issue one, and then we move on to some more sci-fi elements by introducing the Silver Surfer in issue two and building up this pretty heady story. I believe in either issue two or issue three that things got kind of weird, but still handled well enough that you can follow along. It never really gets confusing, and one of the best things I can say about it is, unlike previous Defenders stories we've read, this is never boring or bad. It is sufficiently entertaining. Sal Buscema, as I've said before, is my favorite Spider-Man artist. He's still pretty new in the game here. He's He's not quite establishing his own unique style. He's still doing a little bit of a Kirby-esque thing, or at least trying to. But he is finding some ways to work in his own style. It's starting to come together. I'm starting to see some of that Sal Buscema that I know bleeding through these pages. Issue 3 in particular has not necessarily like creative layouts, but it's what he does inside the panels that makes it look really cool. It has this kind of trippy 70s lava lamp thing going on, if you will. That's the best way I can really describe what I'm seeing. Liked his handling of Silver Surfer a lot. Think that there's a good dynamic that he's got going on with the team. He gives everybody a very unique flavor. And then, of course, the writing is, I think, pretty excellent overall. It's maybe not the – I don't know if it'll be the best Steve Englehart stuff that we read. I'm sure that his Avengers is something that certainly couldn't be any worse than what we've read up to now, we hope. But the way he handles each of these characters in this book gives me a lot of hope that his Avengers is really going to turn things around for that book. It's going to become something that we actually really look forward to reading. This is good stuff. I'm very pleasantly surprised that this Defenders starts with an issue 1 that does not spend all of its time calling back to the stuff that we've read about with this particular team up before. There's not a ton of exposition. It just says, these guys have worked together before. They're all coming back together. We're going to reference back to a couple of issues. You've probably already read them, but even if you hadn't, it doesn't matter. You can actually just pick up into this book and go. Don't worry about all the stuff that came before. This is still just a whole lot of fun. And really, that's why I liked it so much, is because as I was reading it, while it's not breaking any molds or anything, it's just fun. So that's what these comics, I think, you know, should be around this time, or at least what a comic like this should be.
Awesome. Todd, your thoughts here on Defenders 1 through 3?
Well, I find the book skillfully made, good art. The characters especially are well-drawn, very distinctive from one another. I don't really like any of the characters here. I am having a hard time finding a reason to root for them, other than just saying, okay, well, let's watch them fight and argue and bicker. And I know there's heroism there. There's interesting stories. I don't need to read about the Nameless One ever again. But the book itself, it's quality, but I'm thinking it's not for me yet. There's nothing for me to go. I want to read about the further adventures of Doctor Strange being a condescending prick, or Namor being an even more condescending prick, or Silver Surfer whining a whole bunch. Because Surfer, he is. He's whining a lot here. However, compared to Avengers, yes, this is certainly better. And the art gives it a different flavor, a different style. I really like the Sal art here. So, yeah, I suppose I will keep an eye on it, but not a lot for me to glom onto and appreciate. You know, I'm not rooting for this team yet. I want to, but I don't get it yet. So I suppose I will see where we go with Defenders in the next couple of years.
Outstanding. Tim, your thoughts here?
Yeah, I was more along the same lines as Russell, I think, with just seeing this as like a breath of fresh air after the Roy Thomas contributions to this assortment of characters. And I don't know. I think it's with Englehart. He just seems to get that comics are a visual medium, which seems like a very simple, obvious thing. But for as skilled as he is as a wordsmith, like, he knows he has to put cool stuff in the plot for his artist to draw. And with that artist being Sal Buscema, they kind of knock it out of the park, where we get some really like awesome looking monsters and our lead characters, who are all like huge powerhouses, have something to just beat the shit out of. And it's hard to go wrong with that. I like that these creators are really embracing the potential there and what you can do with these four characters. Like, rather than trying to find excuses why, oh, so-and-so can't be in this story because they're too powerful. Like, they're really embracing that. And I just think that's it's something rare with, again, a collection of characters like this where there is just so much power on display. But they don't shy away from it at all. So that's pretty cool. And issue three stood out to me, just the whole conceit of Doctor Strange being like, hey, we got to rescue this girl. She sacrificed her life to Barbara. Save us. And that, Barbara. Yes, excuse me, Barbara. And now we have an opportunity to save her, except, oh, wait, terrible horror. Irony. She liked what had become of her. Now she's mad. It's kind of silly. Just she's like screaming nonstop for three pages. But I don't know. I just that worked for me. It really worked. So everything here just kind of
it's charming. Kind of
clicked. It's charming. It is charming. It's creative. It's charming. It's very, very imaginative, I think. This is, while it is calling back to older continuity, again, it's Steve Englehart, it makes good usage of that continuity. He even picks up on, he includes this subplot from that first Marvel feature story with the Omegatron and the atomic clock, and oh shit, now that's active again. And it kind of made me want to go back and revisit that story, because I know we read it. And I'm like, man, he's keeping a lot of plates spinning here as Steve Englehart and doing it quite deftly. So I found this just pretty impressive. Again, not huge high expectations, but so far so good.
Outstanding. Well, from one Englehart-Buscema collaboration to another, as we checked in with Captain America and the Falcon in the pages of Captain America 153 through 156. This story sees us pick up with Cap, and he and Nick Fury are about to have it out. A little bit of a disagreement between the two that turns into fisticuffs, and eventually it leads to, you know, them coming to terms over their common misunderstanding. Nick Fury is able to finally get his woman Val to admit her love for him. Steve and Sharon take off to a romantic Caribbean getaway, just to go and enjoy each other's company for a time. Sharon is teasing quitting SHIELD.
Southern Caribbean cruise.
Yep. Sharon is teasing quitting SHIELD, even though Nick refuses to accept her resignation. And everything seems to be going well for our heroes until another Captain America pops up, despite Steve and Sharon being gone on vacation. And wouldn't you know it, this Captain America not only has a Bucky, but he's also a terrible, terrible racist and is ranting about the evils of, well, the coloreds. I mean, I didn't say it. The book said it. I'm not the one saying it. This is certainly an interesting story. It introduces the idea that there was another Captain America in the 50s, a guy who was so obsessed with Steve Rogers that he even took Steve Rogers as his name, and that he was able to recreate the Super Soldier Serum, but without the essential Vita rays, the Super Soldier Serum had negative impacts on his psyche, and that is what has led to his deteriorating mental state and his desire to be a little bit more hardline than the Cap that we know and love. Interesting is the best way I can put this. compared to a lot of Cap stories that we've read in the last couple of years, at least it holds my interest. But man, subtlety. Again, this is another one of those books where there's not really much here in the way of subtlety. And I'll turn it over to our Captain America correspondent, Tim Capel. Tim, tell me about this four-part story.
Well, I don't know if I'm losing all credibility here, but I kind of like this. I mean, I kind of thought – not just liked it. I would say I kind of thought it was good. I know that's saying right. Something, perhaps. Yes, there's some very cringy racial elements here, but at least the other Captain America, as he's referred to, is explicitly framed as the bad guy. This is not one of those road to hell paved with good intentions type things that we saw in our last terrible, terrible outing with Captain America. So at least, even though there's some very, very unfortunate language, we are not by any means meant to sympathize with this character. But wow, what a huge continuity patch we are doing that I don't know that anyone asked for, but Steve Englehart seemed to be game. Once again, seems like the type of move out of Roy Thomas's playbook, but executed, I think, much more successfully here by one Steve Englehart, who literally is taking pages from a 1950s comic that actually exists and drops them into his story. And this was in, I believe, issue 155. And somehow it kind of works. I mean, that's incredibly surreal to see, but it's remarkable just the way that it still flows with this retcon that he is setting up that, oh, yeah, those Captain America comics you read in the 50s when we said he was on ice. Well, turns out it was this other dude. Here's his story. So this guy is – he is unnamed here, but he is William Burnside. He is the future Grand Director, a character who we will see over and over again throughout the years. He has his own Bucky as well, who we will also continue to see. And I will not say any more on that for the sake of spoilers, I suppose.
I'm no mad about that.
God bless you. Yeah, so I think that this is good because it is the first real deconstructionist story with Captain America that we have read. And that's going to be a recurring theme for this character throughout the decade of the 70s. And I think it is very, very effective in presenting a Captain America who did not change with the times, just this hypothetical, what if the guy was still the way that he was in the 50s as those comics presented the character? What if he was frozen in time, so to speak, without actually being frozen in a block of ice? And it's illustrating how dangerous that would be, you know, some 30 years removed from the character's actual creation. So I think that's a worthwhile examination and the type of thing that you sort of want to do with Captain America, who is just an inherently anachronistic type of character who nonetheless is this huge like Marvel icon. So it just works for me on a lot of levels. Less to say on the like Steve Sharon stuff. I don't really care about that. The dust up between him and Nick Fury in issue 153. Yeah, I guess it's inevitable that these two would come to blows at some point, their romantic tensions boiling over. They've had it bad for each other, Steve and Nick, since, gosh, those early Strange Tales stories by Stan Lee, where they were very much wanting to get in each other's pants. And
they blame each other for Stranko leaving.
That's exactly what it must be. I guess it's an okay fight scene, but I kind of could have done without it. But once we get to the meat of this with that other Captain America and other Bucky, I was pretty into it, I have to say. So somebody tell me I'm crazy and just being a ridiculous, biased, overly patriotic idiot here.
Todd, is he crazy?
This was fun. I think it's just impressive as hell what Englehart does with the Ron here. And the sunburn aspect of Steve and Sharon is nice. And by the way, they're still not calling her Sharon, right? Or did I miss that?
I think we are.
I think they are.
Steve is calling her Sharon, and Nick Fury is still calling her Agent, whatever.
Agent 13,
Agent 13. The racist Captain America is kind of hard to deal with, hard to tolerate. It's just such a corruption, a thing that It's like seeing evil Superman. You know, you just can't process it. And love just the way he wedged it in and used this historical thing where there was Captain America in the 50s, and they called him Steve Rogers in the comics. But to tell the tale Stan did with the Avengers and kind of giving life to that concept in the Silver Age, fixing this problem. And not just fixing this problem, but using it to tell an interesting story and to reinforce what makes the real Captain America so unique. So, yeah, I love this in its own way. I thought the art by Buscema was not as good as his Defender's art, but still strong. And the Nick Fury Michelin Man arm is kind of a trip. that look. I thought that kind of thing with Nick and Val was silly, and Nick still feels like Ben Grimm at times, the way they write him. I did like just kind of the resolution of and how useful Falcon was here. So I enjoyed that quite a bit.
And that's a good point.
I think we're going to see more interesting stuff like this from Englehart. And what a first year for him here at Marvel.
Absolutely. Russell, your thoughts here.
Subtlety, thy name is not Captain America. But other than that, these are strong issues. I actually really enjoyed the intrigue, the espionage side of Captain America more than anything else. And then having this lookalike come in and really screw up his reputation. That was really interesting to me, and I was not as aware of the 1950s Cap. So seeing that as a nice bit of retcon and like being able to work those types of comics, that character into the 1970s modern Captain America, that was some really good writing on Steve Englehart's part. I thought it was a smart script pretty much throughout, and this is yet another set of issues where we can point to and say, guys, comics have been political all along, because this one got into how the 1950s Cap, as said by the Falcon, sounds exactly like Hitler, and he reacts much like anybody today seems to react whenever you point out that they're using the same language. They get all like belligerent and vindictive over it, and it's like, well, if you don't want to be called a racist, stop saying and doing racist things.
Stop being a racist.
Yeah, it's like, stop. How about you listen to the things you're saying?
Yeah, Mom.
And but yeah, those were some really good moments. Some stuff I was confused on, Tim, and maybe you can answer this. At what point did Steve Rogers' identity become public knowledge? And up to now, as I understood it, the version of Captain America we were reading, as has been called out in Avengers and other places, had no superpowers. So now they're talking about Super Soldier Serum, and I kind of started to feel like I missed something somewhere.
Yeah, we're still at the point where that's a little bit vague as far as what the Super Soldier Serum is. I believe at this point the idea is it does confer some degree of like superhuman strength, senses, that whole deal. But if you ask like Mark Gruenwald, another big continuity junkie, I think his opinion would be no, it's just peak human strength. It's not to the point of being superhuman, but it's as good of a human as you could possibly be. And there's just different takes on what it means.
Sure.
Just depending on the era, depending on the writer. I think it does actually get addressed. But here the idea is it is kind of giving you superpowers. As far as the identity, I don't think that his identity was necessarily known to the general public, but within like military and official circles, everyone would have known. So that's why when this other Captain America adopted the name Steve Rogers, certain people were aware of what he was going for and doing, but it wasn't like a whole thing where everyone's saying, hey, why is Captain America now teaching classes at this school?
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, he was obsessed with Captain America. Okay, fair enough. But, man, if at that time, Steve Rogers' identity would definitely not have been publicly known. So he just decided to make himself look like this random dude when he didn't have to. He could have just given himself the super soldier serum and become Captain America, and nobody would have been the wiser. But no, he decides to go through with the whole plastic surgery bit. Yeah, like he goes the extra obsessive mile, which kind of makes him a more effective, like psychotic villain, I guess. And then he finds somebody as crazy as he is to impersonate Bucky. So, yeah, overall.
Which is we didn't talk about how weird that whole. Talk about Larry Trask and Judge Chalmers and their relationship over in that Avengers story. This fake Steve Rogers and would be Bucky, his young charge here, is like. very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's some cringy stuff, but at the same time, you see, that's the point. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. It's not supposed to be like, this is not the standard stock villain. This dude is like certifiably insane, and he's that from the jump. I actually really enjoyed it for that. I think Englehart has got a good handle on Captain America. And these are the issues of Cap that I've enjoyed most since those Steranko issues. So this is some good stuff. I'm really enjoying what we've got going on here. I thought the artwork was done pretty well too. So more Sal Buscema work. You know, the guy is really coming through. He's starting to really find his footing. And, you know, maybe one day, 10, 20 years from now, whenever we finally make it to the 90s and his spectacular Spider-Man work, we'll be able to point out why I love the dude so much. But it's nice to visit his older work and see him like becoming that artist slowly but surely. Captain America and the Falcon continues to be some pretty good stuff under this creative team. Hopefully this continues on for a while.
Two things before I forget. This is probably the best villain origin story I've read in a long time, at least as far as these old ones go. More in depth, and just I really appreciated how far he went in that third issue. Also, why couldn't they have given an Austrian accent to the Beach Bully? Who was named Arnold? Because weren't we
a little bit pre Schwarzenegger in 1972?
I think he was just making the scene. I don't know. You're the expert.
He was appearing in
Pumping Iron was 74, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but he came over from Austria about then, and did it. Yeah. I'm not going to do it. Greg does it much better.
Yes.
All the Charles Atlas and Joe Weider type ads in the comics of this era, Arnold Schwarzenegger's in a lot of those. So I think, once again, it's because earlier in this story, there's a direct reference by Sharon Carter to those stupid Charles Atlas ads, and you're just a big dumb jock who kicks sand in people's faces, and, you know, it's sort of, it's being very satirical, but I think it's kind of combining that with the actual growing familiarity of Arnold Schwarzenegger at this time.
Fair enough. Moving on to the final title we're going to discuss today. And throughout 1972, we've seen a few attempts by Marvel to tap into a female readership, whether it be Shanna the She-Devil in our first part of our discussion on 1972, or the Night Nurse in our second part of our discussion on 1972. We wrap up 1972's discussion with another female hero introduced, this time being the Cat, a.k.a. Greer Grant, which is certainly a name that baffles the tongue for whatever reason for me, but nonetheless. Interesting here that Greer Grant is written by a female writer, Linda Feit, and also has Marie Severin on art. So I'm trying to remember, guys. Is this the first first predominantly female team in Marvel Comics history? I think it might be. I know Wally Wood is also listed as being on art, but Marie Severn is listed first. So I'm going to count it. But compared to the other two books that I just mentioned, those being Night Nurse and Shannon the She-Devil, I think this is probably the strongest of the three. I think it has an origin that is a bit tragic with her, you know, Greer Grant being portrayed as a woman who had always kind of let men run her life. And then when tragedy takes her beloved husband away from her, she kind of has to set out and make her own path. And she's very successful in doing so. And she's instantly, you know, pretty recognizable. You can see why people would attach themselves to this character. I know she's not long for the air. I think her series is only four issues, but I don't know. Of the three, you know, female books that they're trying to push here in 72, I think this was probably my favorite. Tim, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I would have to agree. It's the of those three female centric lead solo titles that came out this year, this is the only straightforward superhero book of the bunch. But it's really the standout and easily being the strongest. I don't think inherently because it's a superhero title, I think it's just much better written and drawn as well. I like the way it starts out. Well, I say I like it, but this depiction of Greer's married life and just the domestic bliss is kind of shocking and awful at first. And just like, you're almost going, oh God, they can't be sincere about this. Right. But then it makes this like,
you also waiting on him to hit her.
Kind of.
That's what it felt like it was leading
and
to.
And for her to just be okay with it. Like, it was really holy shit type of stuff. But it takes this 180 with the husband getting killed and Greer kind of looking inward and realizing she has this inner strength and so on and so forth. We spend a shocking amount of time with this very brave and capable middle-aged woman who is a scientist who is like going around and learns all the secrets of this. I don't even know how to describe what this guy is trying to do. It's like the plot out of a Linda Carter Wonder Woman episode, in a good way. I didn't think that was – I'm not saying that disparagingly. But this just eccentric villain, Donald Bane, one of those very, I don't know, almost stock-type characters – but, yeah, the doctor, Dr. Tomolo, she gets killed, and I actually sort of felt something there. Like, I wasn't getting attached to her, I would say, but I could see how our protagonist would really be moved by this and to take the actions that she does. And so, basically, we get the future Tigra, Todd Weber, I know your favorite character, and
what a character.
The future Hellcat's costume here. So it's kind of a weird, weird way to start out here. But yeah, I found it surprisingly, it sounds bad to say more competent than I was expecting going in, but it really was. This is a character I'm not overly familiar with, but I'm kind of like, yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing more stories like this with this character and perhaps in a team setting. Hint, hint. We'll see.
Okay. Good to hear. Todd, your thoughts here on the Cat?
No, I'd never read this story before, though I was familiar with her later incarnation, and it's quite frankly difficult for me to reconcile the two. But we shall see. Characters develop and they evolve and they change. But a very unique story with the middle-aged Dr. Tomolo. What a name. What a character. And just this very interesting, please don't touch me villain. You know you're not allowed to touch me. And I've got this giant bald man in yellow BVDs running around too. So quite the peculiar comic, but this is extremely earnest. I really like the way they wrote Greer, although that's a strange name for a woman. You don't hear that too often. I liked the tale of the failed cat character too. You know, the redhead partner who wasn't right for the experiments. And again, not knowing this and not knowing that it was the future Tiger, you'd think, oh, this is Hellcat. This is just a different version. But as we know, Hellcat's going to be a totally different person wearing this costume and featuring similar abilities. But we'll get to that, even though we have met that character before here in Marvel. So I suppose it's of a piece with Night Nurse and Shan of the She-Devil, although it's more, like you said, more traditionally superhero. The quality is about the same to me, although it's not as ironically fun as Night Nurse. Nothing could be as ironically fun as Night Nurse, one of the world's goofiest comics. This is almost old-fashioned and new-fashioned at the same time. The story is rather old-fashioned, but the characterization of her is very contemporary for the time. So better than I expected. We shall see what happens to this character in the future.
Outstanding. Russell, your thoughts here.
I read Mal Donnellbain as Thanatos, who just doesn't like to be touched. That's don't touch me. He's touching me. This was pretty fun. Overall, it gave me real Catwoman vibes at the beginning. Of course, for the aesthetic that she has chosen, of course. But just in the early characterization, especially in that opening action scene, I was getting like real Selena Kyle vibes. But moving on from that, the good God, her name is – that is just not – that's not going to be rolling off the tongue very easy, is it?
I'm glad I'm not the only person who had issues with that.
It's not the best name they could have chosen by any stretch, for sure. It's a good thing that you're going to be dealing with this character mostly in print.
I wonder if Linda Fight like had a friend or relative or something named Greer and just thought it was an unusual name and would make a good comic character.
Probably. It's possible something like that happened. But as I was saying earlier, the relationship with her policeman husband really felt uncomfortable. Like it was something I was waiting for the abuse to start, you know, just as it's building up. I'm like, oh, God, this is going to turn real bad real fast, isn't it? And it doesn't really come to that. And then the twist, he's the one who dies.
Right.
Through like – basically just protecting her. Like he stands between her and certain death and, you know, he is killed because of it. And she, you know, goes on, she rediscovers that inner strength she had prior to meeting him. She's like, oh, wait a minute. I had a life before this. I want to try and get back to that and, you know, try to build my own self up, like make something of myself in this world. And this is really progressive for the 70s. It's really done pretty well. I found the action scenes in this to be done pretty well. I think the eccentric villain is also a bit fun. I think, you know, he's over the top in all the right ways. There's a good message overall on this. I didn't find the dialogue to be too stilted. I thought that it was done pretty well. Linda Fight's pretty skilled writer. She's got a good voice for her characters. She has individual voices for her characters. That's another like positive thing that we can call out here. And the Marie Severin art is real good. So overall, I got to agree with you guys. This was the strongest of those three female-centric books that we read for 1972. This is the one that jumps out. This is it's standing above the other two, although I got to say I like Shauna the She-Devil more than you guys probably did. And Night Nurse is just probably unintentionally hilarious. But this seems to get all the beats right. It to me is one that, you know, I would think that this probably would hit pretty well with female readership, but it still feels like a book that male readership should be able to pick up and enjoy too. Strong stuff from beginning to end. I enjoyed the origin tale as well. Thought that was told very well, like interspersing the backstory between the moments of what's happening in the here and now. So good stuff. Good introduction to this. I also enjoyed the last little tease there at the end, because the owl is coming in and he's more known as a daredevil villain. But I kind of, the more I thought about it, the more I really want to see that villain versus this new hero. I think that there's something to that. I would actually very much like to see where this goes. So, unfortunate this book only lasts 4 issues, because this first issue, that's good stuff. Really, really good opening.
Gotcha. Well, that brings a close to our discussion of the various titles that we read for 1972. But because this is the last of our 3 episodes on 1972, we're going to move on to our year-end awards. And we're going to start this time out. Let's start with the cover of the year. And I actually have an answer ready. I was perusing as you guys were discussing the cat. And I'm going to go with Amazing Spider-Man number 112. This is a John Romita cover. It's got mass chaos in the streets of New York as a giant image of Spider-Man just kind of looks down and is like, hey, man, fuck you guys. I'm washing my hands of all of you. I'm done with you. And that's an interesting concept for a Spider-Man story, and it's a great image. So I'm going to go Spider-Man 112. Todd, you're the cover aficionado here. What you got?
Well, how could I pick anything but that famous fabled thrift store comic, Spider-Man 112, that I received when I was, 12 years old? And has been one of my favorite covers for a long time. So I was going to pick that anyway. I will also give an honorary runner-up to Avengers 100, which was all cover and no book.
Well done, sir. Tim, your cover of the year.
Can I just say the covers this year kind of suck?
I was looking through.
Yeah.
The Dickens were pretty slim, I thought. Like, if not for Spider-Man 112, I was probably going to give it to one of those Tomb of Dracula covers.
We still have that piece at the top and the bottom that's annoying.
The problem. Right. They're really hampered by this weird design element where it's this sort of window pane with action. It's very claustrophobic, all of these covers. Just the way that – I don't know why they thought that was a good idea, and I hope it does not last much longer. So I will say I heard it mentioned Tomb of Dracula. Yeah, I'll say Tomb of Dracula number one. Tells you right away what it is. Very striking image. It's so gothic but so classy looking at the same time. Very atmospheric. The smoke and the fog, and I mean, proclaiming it's a vampire. And I think we sort of slept on the fact of what a big deal it is to have a straight up vampire appearing in a code approved comic now, because they've kind of relaxed those rules. So right away you're going, holy shit, this is something that I've not seen before in Marvel Comics. So yep, I'm going to give it to Tomb of Dracula number one.
Russell, your cover of the year.
As you said, this was tough because our pickings were real slim. Not a great year for covers. But like Tim, I was more impressed by Tomb of Dracula than just about anything else. But I'm not going issue one. I'm going issue two.
That would have been the one I would have as well.
I almost – you know what? I'll go ahead and say issue two then.
Yeah. I think that this image is very striking. The transformation of from a bat into his vampiric form over what is likely to be his next victim, and the onlookers from underneath a bridge like watching this happen. It's a striking image. It's of course is a night scene. It's you got these kind of cobblestone streets that this girl is laying on. This is just an image
having
that
it
sticks
in the city
with me.
As opposed to the country of the first of the cover for issue one. It kind of just adds, I don't know, something a little bit more terrifying to me about that image than the cover for one.
Yeah, it's really striking. The positioning of Dracula himself, just how he's off-center from the cover, like he was in issue one, but this just this jumps out at me more. This is kind of a classic cover. This is an image of Tomb of Dracula that I was already familiar with before reading the book. And seeing it, I'm like, this, like seeing it and then putting the context with it with the rest of the issue, yeah, I got to give it to this one. Tomb of Dracula number two is actually, I know we said there are slim pickings this year, but I'm actually going to say this is a really great cover overall anyway. So, yeah, pretty clear pick for me.
Gotcha.
Solidarity.
So a split between Amazing Spider-Man 112 and Tomb of Dracula number two. Let's move on to our – let's go villain of the year. And this one's interesting because – I feel like 1972, we read more variety throughout the list than most years. So there's not any, you know, obvious choice that just jumps out to me. And as much as we kind of – I kind of had some fun with him earlier, maybe it's the recency bias. But of the options provided here, I kind of feel like I have to go the Captain America of the 1950s for the villain of the year. I just – nothing else really stands out to me. And that – like you guys – the origin was pretty cool, and it was nice to see, you know, a mentality kind of get called out for its bullshit and make something of a political statement, even though we have it on good authority that comics were not political until like 2012. So, Russell, who you got for villain of the year?
Well, if we're going on Boo Factor, which is a character that's likely to elicit quite the many boos from the fandom, I think I have to go with the High AF Evolutionary. Because just for sheer boredom alone, but I'm kidding. He's not a villain, but he should be. This is tough because I get where you're going with the 1950s Cap. I think that's a really great pick. But man, I think I'm going to have to give it to. I'm going to call back to Dracula again. I'm going to give it to Dracula. I really love how he's portrayed in Tomb of Dracula. I think that Jerry Conway is just absolutely killing it on that title. It's one that came out of nowhere, really just struck me as a fantastic story, a really great handling of this classic character who like everybody is familiar with, but he's doing interesting things with him. He's moving that story forward rather than just revisiting the same old, same old. So that's what really sticks out in my mind as something that's really interesting. And yeah, we had a plethora of villains this time around, so there was no shortage of them to choose from, but Tomb of Dracula's lead character, Dracula, really stood out to me in this year's title. So I got to give the award to him.
Tim, you're a villain of the year.
Roy Thomas. No, I will say that call it recency bias, call it Captain America bias, but it's that 1950s Cap.
Well done, sir. Todd, you're villain of the year.
Were my children not asleep, nor my guitar not in the studio, I would take it down and play the familiar strains of Dust in her Hooch, because May Parker is the villain of the year. What a terrible... She tried to shoot Spider-Man.
She did.
With a gun.
She hit him with a vase.
Aunt May was packing.
Oh, but runner-up to racist Captain America.
Yeah, racist Captain America. Outstanding. So on the flip side, the hero of the year... most years, I feel like I've gone with Spider-Man whenever he's been a viable option, and he's certainly a viable option here, but I'm going to switch it up a little bit. I'm going to go Daredevil. I think these six issues that we read in 72, Daredevil has found his stride. The San Francisco move has been a great status quo shift for him, and everything's kind of clicking for Matt Murdock right now. And so, yeah, I'm going to go Daredevil. Todd, your hero of the year.
Werewolf by Night, away from here. Werewolf by Night, Jack Russell is my hero of the year, even though he's not really a hero. He's more of an anti-hero in his own book. But
protagonist of the year.
Yeah, there we go. Jack Russell. Although Daredevil has almost become a Black Widow book to me. You know, he's a supported character in his own book, it feels like at times.
Good point. Tim, your hero of the year.
Dr. Tomolo. No.
Hot.
I mean, I think I will also go with Jack Russell. I mean, when else are we really going to get an opportunity to give Hero of the Year to Werewolf by Night? I think Daredevil is going to have his day. Otherwise, I would say he's my runner-up. But, no, I will agree with Todd here and say Jack Russell. We spent a good bit of time with him. Kind of got to know the character, enjoyed his stories. So, sure, let's give him the nod.
Absolutely. Russell, your Hero of the Year.
Jerry Conway.
No, we have a category for that coming up.
Yeah, well, I'm going to fly back to the tried and true Amazing Spider-Man, Peter Parker. I think that his issues continue to show why this character works so well, because he is all of us. He is that guy who would, you know, probably handle these situations much like we all would. We would try our best, but ultimately we would all wind up suffering from IBS and really, really invest heavily in Tums, which probably would have been kind of – I don't know if they're a new thing in the 70s, but they certainly would have seen their stock rise quite a bit. He's got a lot of issues going on, but he is handling it all with about as much poise and grace as anyone probably could given the circumstances, especially dealing with that old trifling bitch, Aunt May. And this is good stuff for me. He's my winner, the Amazing Spider-Man.
Absolutely. Let's move on to our Artist of the Year. I'm going to go Gene Colan here for a variety of reasons. The Daredevil work, his work on some of the horror titles, I believe he was involved with Tomb of Dracula and some of the other stuff that we saw this year. Just kind of, I don't know, something about it just feels distinctive to me. It feels different than everything else we're seeing right now in Marvel. And the books he's on, he fits so incredibly well. I'm loving it. So Gene Colan for me. Tim, what about you?
Same, Gene Colan with a bullet, Tomb of Dracula, Daredevil, either one of those alone, I think would have been sufficient, but seeing him just knocking out of the park on both books, which are extremely elevated by his presence, yeah, easily.
Todd, your Artist of the Year.
Gene Colan as well, with a runner-up to Mike Ploog.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. Russell.
Let's clean sweep it for the guy, Gene Colan. Top to bottom, for all the reasons that you guys said, love everything he did on Tomb of Dracula and on Daredevil. The guy is he's easily the superstar of the year, but I'm going to give my runner-up to John Romita and his work on Amazing Spider-Man. But yeah, this is good shit.
Absolutely. Moving on to Writer of the Year. I feel like this one should be pretty unanimous. While I feel like Steve Englehart is certainly beginning to make a name for himself and will probably be in the running for this award in future years, it has to be Jerry Conway in 1972. I don't really see another candidate unless somebody else would care to make the case for one. Todd?
No.
Tim?
No, but Englehart is rapidly gaining.
Yes,
on
Conway. I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Russell?
Roy Thomas. Nope.
Oh, God.
said no one ever. So it's another clean sweep. It's Jerry Conway. It has to be. There are, as you guys said, Steve Englehart, he's making a run for it. He's probably going to win it at some point down the road, but Stan, the man, has started to pass the torch along, and I think that Jerry Conway is the kid who picked it up and ran with it.
Absolutely. And then finally, our Story of the Year. Lots of different ways we could go. I could go Daredevil here. I could go with some of those horror books, whether it be Tomb of Dracula or Werewolf by Night. Instead, I'm going to take the predictable route. I'm going to go Thor 200. Absolutely love this. And in addition to me loving it, it's also incredibly influential and important. The closest parallel that I can draw is it's kind of like that Alan Moore story, Tigers, that he did for Green Lantern, that Geoff Johns came along later and basically lifted for the majority of his Green Lantern run. This Thor story will be referred to by virtually every writer
who writes the character for the rest of his existence. It's that influential. It matters that much in terms of the continuity of Thor and of what his deal is. So Thor 200, the Ragnarok story, is my story of the year. Todd, what about you?
The Elton John, Doc Ock, Hammerhead saga in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man. But there were a lot of good stories, and I appreciated being able to read almost a whole year worth of Daredevil in there. That was pretty great, too.
Absolutely. Russell, your story of the year.
You know, I had the same thoughts you did about Thor number 200, so I kind of got to give it to that one for just the sheer amount of stuff that's going to be built from it going forward. This is this story is a game changer. It it shifts the entire narrative of Thor for ever and ever. Amen, I guess, because every writer since has been referencing it. This is the true, like, I guess you call this Thor rebirth. It's the moment where his true future takes hold. This is maybe the most important Thor story up to this point. Maybe the most important Thor story, period. So, there it is. Gotta say, this is essential reading. If you're going to read Thor, you got to read this book. I would even say, here, read this if this is your first time ever reading Thor. So, Thor number 200.
Absolutely. Tim, your story of the year.
Perhaps off the beaten path a little bit, I am going to give it to Amazing Adventures, the Beast solo outing.
X-Men Truther.
I'm not kidding.
Take your X-Men where you can get it, huh?
I'm not kidding. I really do think this was excellent. Like, Beast... Fun. Is a great Beast is a great character. I think he's a character that it's hard to do too bad by him, but when you really get it right, he particularly shines. And we have a combination of Jerry Conway and Steve Englehart telling the story of his transformation into the iconic version of Beast that we all know and love so well. And it kind of blew me away. I know I had read at least that first issue before, but I hadn't followed the continuing saga of Hank McCoy in Amazing Adventures. And I was really into it. It kind of spoke to me. So this was an easy pick for me, as unconventional or conventional, predictable by my standards as it may be. Yeah, Amazing Adventures.
All right, so... variety of different answers on our year-end awards, but that's what makes the show great, getting to hear all of our perspectives and differing opinions. So with that being said, that concludes our discussion of 1972. When next we join you, we'll be jumping into 1973, and what we'll be talking about, I believe, is yet to be determined. Tim, you got any updates on that for us?
Yeah, I just need to get that updated on the Google Doc, but I can tell you we will have a major, major debut of a major Marvel Cinematic Universe player in the player in the player the pages of Iron Man of all
things. Yes.
So yes. Look for that.
We will also
continue to take our X-Men where we can get them. with a fun crossover story with the Avengers coming up. I regret to inform you there will be more Warlock.
God almighty.
I perhaps regret to inform you there will be Captain Marvel.
I'm looking at the sheet, and the only two things that are listed, I'm ready to just lose my shit over. So
those will stay put.
For fuck's sake!
Those will be staying put because I know they're your favorite.
Oh my god!
You can't wait.
Fuck that parade.
If and when the apocalypse ever comes, I hope it begins in Rutland, Vermont, and raises that plate to fucking ground.
Can we incorporate the DC Universe app into this?
Oh, no.
Let's see if that story is on. Let's see if that issue is on there.
I'm sure it is.
Tom Fagan.
Oh, God. Oh, my. Anyway.
Nick was having such a great day with the Falcons beating the 49ers.
See, you brought it up, not me. Why?
I don't think the Niners are as good as their record. So
well, they beat the Saints last week, so that's all that matters. But this isn't a football show, and Tim's about to commit suicide over here if we turn it into one. So in any event, let's
as much as you are over mentions of Rutland, Vermont.
For fuck's sake. Let's wrap this baby up by giving everybody an opportunity to plug their shit as always. I, of course, am one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are well on our way in the countdown to episode 200, our big anniversary show coming up in February. So we got some random episodes planned out for the next couple of weeks. We honestly don't even know what we're doing. I think we're going to do a Star Wars tie-in for a long book. We're going to actually look at a Alan Moore penned Star Wars story that's on Marvel Unlimited called Star Wars Devil World. So that's coming up in a couple of weeks. We got a countdown of something we haven't decided on, and then January is going to be Arrow month. It is going to be our love letter to the show Arrow as it airs its final episodes in the month of January. So stay tuned for that. Tim, I know you've got numerous things going on. Plug your shit, sir.
Okay. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, our sister feed on Place to Be Nation Pop, I do a show called Talkin' WCW with Jennifer Smith and with Greg Phillips, he being one half of the long track, the hard traveling fanboys as well.
Like that.
I can officially no longer speak tonight, guys.
It's late, guys. This is the latest podcast recording we've done on this show, so I feel for you.
Yeah. Our most recent episode of Talking WCW, what the hell was it about? It was about Brett, the Hitman Hart, his 2-year and change tenure in World Championship Wrestling. It was a pretty ridiculous episode about a ridiculous human being. I had a lot of fun doing it. You should check it out. I'm a frequent contributor on the Jenny position as well. So Jennifer Smith has a new podcast feed. You can look for it on your favorite podcatcher app. It is called The Jenny Position. Talkin' Pop, the show we did together, has migrated to that feed, can still be found there, along with a lot of other great and wonderful content. I think that will do it for my purposes.
Russell, plug your shit.
This is the only show I'm doing right now.
All right. Good answer.
Of course, DC4U that Todd and I do, that has reached the end of its first season. Go back and listen to the archives of that. We had fun doing it, and hope to be doing that again real soon. The other show that I do, 90 to Nothing with Sam Neely, we're in a little bit of a hiatus at the moment. We're not going to get to a premiere just as quickly as we thought, but stay tuned. We'll probably be announcing something on that in the very near future.
Good deal. And Todd, finally, plug your shit, sir.
You've been listening to the Marvel Age podcast.
Well, good to know. Good to know that you guys are busy as always. DC4U, of course, on hiatus, but we're looking forward to that coming back for its second season when the time comes. So with all that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we hope you've enjoyed this discussion of 1972. Be sure to be with us next time when we talk some 1973 in Marvel Comics. Till then, enough said.